Okay, everybody ready? Yes? Round of support, yes? Give me a hand, yes. Okay, charge up the room. All right, very good. Very good. Okay, so without further ado, Taya Temin, gonna be speaking on, oh, by the way, we've now switched into a different session. Picture me with long hair and a hip t-shirt. I'm Pat Slain, okay? And we're gonna do the new session on Pulsar Wind Nebulae. And Taya Temin, please go ahead. This is a half hour talk.
All right, first of all, thank you so much to the organizers for inviting me. The conference has been really nice so far, even though I've missed quite a few sessions, unfortunately. And just a disclaimer, I wanted to be here so badly that I brought my two-month-old baby. So in case I miss to mention some recent works, that's because of the sleep deprivation. It's not intentional, so just a disclaimer. All right, so I am going to talk about composite supernova remnants, and I'm going to focus on the most recent work that they came out in the last 3 years, so since the last time that we met here. Composite supernova remnants are remnants that contain pulsars and pulsar wind nebulae, and what I'm going to emphasize is recent works that aim to constrain the progenitors of these supernova remnants and tell us something about the explosion properties. In particular, by looking at the pulsar wind nebula itself and modeling the pulsar wind nebula evolution in the composite remnants, some additional information about the progenitors can be explored as opposed to in remnants that don't contain pulsar wind nebulae. So that's what I'm going to talk about. So I'm sure you've seen this figure many times because I pretty much use it in every single one of my talks or some version of it. But it very nicely shows the structure of a composite supernova remnant. There's a pulsar in the center that produces a pulsar wind nebula that expands into the innermost supernova ejecta. This is a hydro simulation that has a density gradient increasing to the right, and the pulsar is moving to the north. The pulsar wind nebula initially expands into the ejecta, so then we see this skin of dense ejecta emission that surrounds the pulsar wind nebula. Here is the reverse shock, and here's the forward shock expanding into the circumstellar material. So as this supernova remnant evolves, eventually the reverse shock will propagate towards the pulsar wind nebula and begin interacting with it. And this interaction usually occurs asymmetrically due to these couple of different factors. The fact that there's some structure in the density in the surrounding ambient medium, and also because the pulsars usually have kick velocity. So once that interaction occurs, we get these complex morphologies and the pulsar wind nebula is usually displaced from the center of the supernova remnant. So when I talk about the early evolution or the young pulsar wind nebulae, what I'm referring to is pulsar wind nebulae that are still interacting with the innermost supernova ejecta. So the reverse shock has not yet propagated to reach the pulsar wind nebula. And in those cases, the radius of the pulsar wind nebula does depend on the supernova ejecta mass and the supernova explosion energy. So by modeling these systems in the early evolution, we can put some constraints on these values. When I talk about the late evolution, I'm talking about these systems that are already undergoing this interaction with the reverse shock, and I'll show some examples, and the morphologies of these remnants are very different, and they tell us different information about the systems. Okay, so there are a few different methods that we can use in composite remnants to say something about the progenitor and the explosion properties. So for example, in the young systems, we can, through dynamical modeling of the pulsar wind nebula expansion into the ejecta, we can say something about the ejecta mass and the explosion energy, and particularly the density in the surrounding ejecta environment. We can use these young pulsar wind nebulae to probe the innermost ejecta, because when they're very young and they're still expanding into that material on the inside, the mass that is swept up can be very low, so that means that we're probing the innermost layers of supernova ejecta. And these pulsar wind nebulae, when they're young, also tell us about the supernova dust properties, because they heat that innermost dust that is located that has formed in the ejecta material. In the older systems, we can probe the supernova ejecta both by looking at the reverse shock material as in other remnants, but for pulsar wind nebulae or composite remnants in particular, once that reverse shock interaction occurs, ejecta material mixes with the pulsar wind nebula material, so we can also probe that emission in these evolved systems. And then finally, modeling the supernova remnant evolution, and particularly this interaction with the reverse shock, allows us to constrain additional properties, again, the ejecta mass, but also the structure of the surrounding ISM and CSM environment, as well as the direction of motion and velocity of the pulsars. Okay, so as I mentioned, these young pulsar wind nebulae can be very powerful probes of the innermost ejecta material. One nice example of that is KES-75, so I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about some of the recent works on this particular remnant and what we learned about the innermost ejecta material. This is an X-ray image of KES-75. It has a partial thermal shell. Here's a pulsar wind nebula in the center. It has a well-defined torus and jet structures. KES-75 is interesting because it has the youngest known pulsar. The current pulsar period is around 320 milliseconds, but interestingly, the pulsar did exhibit some magnetar-like activity, which makes it even more interesting. And KES-75 was previously hypothesized to have resulted from a type 1b or 1c supernova explosion from a Wolf-Rayet progenitor. And that was mainly due to the fact that it had a large size and applied to large velocities and it had and a clumpy CSM. But that interpretation was based on a previous distance estimate, which was 19 kiloparsecs. And that has since been revised down to about 6 kiloparsecs, which actually significantly changes the interpretation for this particular supernova remnant. So Reynolds et al. Currently had a study of multi-epoch Chandra observations of the pulsar wind nebula in KES-75, and that's what I'm showing here. So this is an X-ray image. They compared images from 2006 and 2016 and measured the motion of the pulsar wind nebula, its expansion, and made an estimate of the expansion velocity. So this, I don't know if it shows up well here, but there's a region here that was used in the Northwest where the expansion could be measured most clearly, and they find an expansion velocity of 1,000 kilometers per second and estimate the true age of the pulsar to be around 500 years. And because that distance estimate has been revised, it is no longer a requirement that this is a type 1b or 1c supernova explosion, and Reynolds et al. Proposed that it could have actually resulted from just a more typical type 2p explosion. So when we looked at the innermost region of the pulsar wind nebula with Herschel, and we see infrared emission surrounding the pulsar wind nebula. So that's a signature of that innermost material. In this case, it's just an image, so we didn't know if that was ejecta or if it was mostly a dust continuum. So we have a recent study that was just accepted last week or a couple of weeks ago to APJ Letters, where we studied this innermost ejecta emission by looking at Herschel spectroscopy. So this is what I'm showing here. We have detections of lines of oxygen 1 at 63 microns, oxygen 3 at 88 microns, and C2 at 157 microns. So what these spectra are integrated over the entire pulsar wind nebula. So what you're seeing here is narrow line emission that comes from the background, but there's an underlying broad line for each of the lines that arises from the supernova ejecta that the pulsar wind nebula is expanding into. And when we measure the line broadening, it actually suggests an expansion of velocity of 750 kilometers per second. And on the top, I am showing the maps of each of the ejecta lines. So in this case, the maps are made by just integrating over the broad line. So the background is excluded here. And you can see that the distribution of the different elements, the spatial distribution is somewhat different for each one, but it is all confined within the contours of the pulsar wind nebula that are shown in white. Okay, so the approach that we took is to run hydrodynamical models to model the evolution of the pulsar wind nebula in KES-75. and the supernova remnant constrained by these observations, the ejecta velocity and the pulsar's parameters. And this plot here shows the results of the hydro simulations, showing the pulsar wind nebula radius on the top and the swept up ejecta mass on the bottom. And this is this shows data for two different supernova ejecta masses, a 10 solar mass model and a 20 solar mass model. And the different lines, the dashed and the solid lines, are predictions depending on what we assume the synchrotron, the early synchrotron losses are for the pulsar wind nebula. So the age that we find is in the range of 500 years, which is consistent with the Reynolds et al. Estimate. And on the bottom, we're showing the swept up ejecta mass in each case, and it ranges from 0.05 to 0.1 solar masses. So this is a very small amount. Whichever assumption we make here, this suggests that we are really probing those innermost layers of supernova ejecta. So our next step was to basically take the pulsar wind nebula radius that we get from these hydro simulations, and then look at that radius, what do we expect the abundances of the ejecta to be based on supernova nucleosynthesis and explosion models by Sukbold et al. 2006. I actually think this should be 2016. Mistake. So this plot shows the two different ejecta masses, 10 solar masses and almost 20 solar masses. This is corresponding to the same masses as in the hydro simulations. And the left columns here are the unmixed ejecta, and the right columns are ejecta that has been, for which mixing has been applied following the nucleosynthesis. So what I'm showing in the gray bands here is the radius at which the pulsar wind nebula has expanded, and the light gray band is that uncertainty in the radius depending on what we assume for the early synchrotron losses. So now, so the next step, so we basically immediately see that for this 19 or 20 solar mass model for the unmixed case, it doesn't really agree with the observations because there are negligible amounts of carbon in that innermost material. And since we are seeing strong carbon emission in those innermost regions, that sort of tells us that that unmixed 20 solar mass case is not going to work in reproducing our observations. But then we're left with these three cases, and our next step was then to take these abundances at these pulsar wind nebula radii, and then use them in shock models to see what we predict for the line emission. Okay, so this plot is a bit complicated, but I'll just explain it very quickly. This is the absolute flux of the lines for different densities as a function of the shock velocity, and the observed emission is shown as these gray lines here. And the bottom plot shows the carbon 2 to oxygen 1 ratio that probes the carbon to oxygen abundance in the innermost ejecta. So we're basically comparing the ratios that we find, our observed ratios, to what we predict for each of those models. So the 19.8 solar mass mixed models, the 10 solar mass mixed, and the 10 solar mass unmixed. So in the 19.8 solar mass mixed model reproduces approximately the absolute fluxes of the lines, but these ratios do not agree. They're overestimated by more than an order of magnitude, so that does not work for our observations. And then for the 10 solar mass mixed case, the ratios work, but then the absolute fluxes are really underestimated by a significant factor. And then the 10 solar mass unmixed case actually works in both cases. We get something that's in the range of our observations. And this isn't necessarily unique, but what we do conclude from that is that the lower mass and explosion energy supernova progenitors with only mildly mixed ejecta profiles are favored in this case. What this plot shows is now the correct date, Sukbold et al. 2016 models for the carbon and oxygen mass fraction as a function of the progenitor mass. And since for our observations, we require that the carbon to oxygen fractions be comparable based on these models here, that it suggests that the progenitor is somewhere, it is not it's not a higher mass than about 12 solar masses or so. And of course, if we had not, we currently have only three lines, but future observations with James Webb will provide additional species that we can compare with these models to maybe even say something about the explosion type itself, which we cannot currently constrain with these data. And just a quick note about the dust, I guess I already made the comment, but for KES-75, these are the continuum images, and they, subtracting the line emission that I showed, does give us a lower dust mass, something on the order of a few times 10 to the minus 3 for the shock, and we conclude that the dust is shock heated by the Pulsar Wind Nebula, and this actually is consistent with the fact that we have a very low ejecta mass, so we expect that the dust mass in that region is going to be very low, but this is still actually a very relatively high dust-to-gas mass ratio. Okay, so now moving on to another young composite supernova remnant, G21.5 minus 0.9. G21 has a symmetric pulsar wind nebula in the center surrounded by this shell of X-ray emission. The shell is attributed to a dust-scattering halo in this region here. In addition, in this, the non-thermal emission in this limb is due to synchrotron emission from particle acceleration by the forward shock. And a recent study by Guest et al. Looked at it's basically the deepest imaging and spectroscopic study of this remnant using Chandra archival data found thermal emission in this eastern limb. I should also mention there's a knot of ejecta emission here that has abundances that imply that it does come from ejecta. But the emission from the eastern limb, this is from this new analysis, gives these parameters. And so now some thermal emission has been detected there, and extending that emission to the full sphere implies a low explosion energy. It's 3 times 10 to the 49 from this study. That method is probably not very, it has large uncertainties, but it perhaps does imply that the explosion energy for G21 is quite low. Furthermore, the fact that we are not seeing a lot of thermal emission, even in these very deep observations, may imply that this supernova remnant is expanding into a windblown bubble that was produced by the progenitor. And I just want to mention, even though I don't have the details of the analysis yet, that's still a work in progress, there is a detection of that innermost supernova ejecta emission with Herschel for G21. This is a previous study by Zajcik et al. 2012 that did find near-infrared iron II emission that's surrounding the Pulsar Wind Nebula. Here's a Pulsar Wind Nebula contour, and you can see that the iron emission sort of wraps around the outermost contour and suggests that that's the ejecta that the Pulsar Wind Nebula is expanding into. And the Herschel detection of carbon II emission is shown here. Again, Pulsar Wind Nebula contours in yellow with the emission shown in these from carbon II shown in these in blue and red. This is the red-shifted and blue-shifted and at the ejecta emission that's at rest. Okay, so I've talked about G54 quite a bit in many of my talks, so I just want to give a quick summary of what's new with this supernova remnant. G54.1 plus 0.3 is another young pulsar wind nebula with that has a well-defined torus and jet structure, and there's a detection of infrared emission around the Pulsar Wind Nebula. And the reason this particular remnant is so interesting because this material is most likely supernova ejecta and dust that is being heated by the stars of the cluster in which that the progenitor belonged to. So this infrared excess that you see at 24 microns here is not actually intrinsic to the stars themselves, but that's dust that's being heated to higher temperatures that's in the vicinity of those stars. So progenitor mass for this particular supernova remnant was estimated using a few different methods. So for example, the initial Spitzer spectroscopy analysis of the line emission using lines of neon, silicon, sulfur, argon, and chlorine were found to have full width half maxima of 1,000 kilometers per second, implying that they're arising from ejecta, and shock diagnostics of those lines did suggest the mass of progenitor. Additionally, a study by Kim et al. Looked at the spectral types of all the stars, those massive stars that were part of the cluster, and they found that the earliest spectral type is an O9 star, and assuming that it's a continuous IMF, that suggested that the progenitor mass, it set a lower limit for the progenitor mass to 17 solar masses. And then finally, dynamical modeling of the Pulsar Wind Nebula by Gelfand et al. Found that, constrained by the information about the innermost supernova ejecta, found that the progenitor mass range is between 15 and 20 solar masses. Most recently, we finally completed the study of the dust emission in G54. And what I'm showing here is the spectrum of the dust from two different locations. And the dust has this very distinctive 21 micron feature that is the same as the feature that is seen in the ejecta dust in CAS A. And what I'm showing here is a pixel-to-pixel fitting of this of the dust, and that results in this basically dust mass density map. The Pulsar Wind Nebula in X-rays is shown in blue. The dust composition was attributed to these magnesium silicate grains in CAS A, and that was, we also used that to successfully fit the dust emission in G54. And what we find is that, assuming that those are the grains that are producing the emission, the lower limit on the dust mass is 0.3 solar masses. So we get something about 0.1 with very large error bars, but this is the lower limit. And again, this only holds if these are the grains that are producing the emission. But using this dust mass, we can compare the mass to the nucleosynthesis yields that are expected, and making that comparison, we find that it would have to be a progenitor mass between 16 and 27 solar masses in order for us to have enough of the material to form this amount of dust. So putting all of that together, it seems that this is a progenitor mass between 17 and 20 solar masses or so. Okay, so G292 is a pulsar or composite remnant that's now probably in the intermediate stage of evolution, where the Pulsar Wind Nebula has not yet been fully crushed by the reverse shock, but the reverse shock has reached the Pulsar Wind Nebula and is perhaps interacting with it. This is a Chandra image of G292. It shows this very complex network of ejecta knots and circumstellar emission. This is a zoomed-in view of the Pulsar Wind Nebula. So a recent study looked at, this is a deep Chandra study that looked at the ejecta distribution in G292, and they found that larger amounts of ejecta are seen to reside opposite of the inferred direction of the neutron star kick direction. So just showing it here, this diagram shows the how much of each of these elements are found in this northwest region versus the southeast region. This is the direction of the pulsar. And particularly elements of silicon, sulfur, and iron are seen to be primarily opposite of the direction of the neutron star kick. And this is consistent with 3D simulations that predict ejecta symmetries dominate over non-spherical neutrino emission in accelerating neutron stars. And this was actually also found for other supernova remnants in CAS A by Holland Ashford et al. And Katsuda et al. And I think Tyler will talk about this, Tyler Holland Ashford will talk about this on Friday, so I won't spend too much time on that. They also looked at the abundance maps for each of these elements. These are abundances relative to solar for oxygen, neon, magnesium, silicon, sulfur, and iron. And looking at these abundance ratios and estimated masses, as well as the circumstellar material masses, this study finds that the progenitor mass is in the range of 13 to 30 solar masses or so for G292. Okay, so now I want to talk about a remnant that is in these late stages of evolution, where the Pulsar Wind Nebula has interacted with the supernova reverse shock. This is MSH1556. This is an image showing the X-ray ROSAT emission in magenta and radio emission in green. So you'll see that there's a symmetric shell, and there's a Pulsar Wind Nebula that is displaced from the geometric center, and it has I can talk about it and just show the images. Okay. I'll continue talking. So there's a disrupted pulsar wind nebula that doesn't have that morphology of those young pulsar wind nebulae where you see the torus and jet structures, but it has a very irregular shape, suggesting that it has interacted with the reverse shock. And what you're not seeing is an XMM image of that innermost region that shows the region of the pulsar wind nebula. And the pulsar is located, if you remember the shape of the pulsar wind nebula, the pulsar is located at the bottom of the tip of that radio PWN. I should probably wait for the images, but we were able to measure the pulsar velocity in the supernova remnant by using Chandra images that were with a 15-year baseline, so 15 years apart. There it is. So here again is the radio image, the pulsar wind nebula, the pulsar is at the tip here. This square here shows that innermost region as observed with Chandra. This is the initial Chandra observation of 56 kiloseconds, and then we had a follow-up 15 years later, 175 kilosecond observations. It shows the pulsar and these features, these sort of arc-like features that traces the edge of the radio pulsar wind nebula. And we were able to measure the proper motion of the pulsar. The pulsar is moving in this direction, and we measured a velocity of about 700 kilometers per second, plus or minus 150. And we used those, we used the constraints based on this pulsar velocity and direction of motion, an additional constraint from the thermal emission of the supernova remnant as inputs to hydro models of the supernova remnant to see what happens with the pulsar wind nebula and also to see whether we can constrain something about the progenitor mass and the density gradient in the surrounding ambient medium. So that's what I'm showing here. I'll play the simulation. So this is a simulation with where the pulsar is at rest. So what you're seeing is that the pulsar is moving in the direction shown by the black arrow, and the reverse shock is reaching the pulsar wind nebula preferentially from one side. And as the reverse shock is interacting with the pulsar wind nebula, it reaches the pulsar and is now sweeping pulsar wind nebula material away from the pulsar. And then once we get to the estimated age for the remnant of about 15,000 years, the final morphology looks something like this. So the density gradient was chosen such that we produce that morphology and the size of the supernova remnant that we observe. I made this from past experience in case the movie didn't work, but I don't have to go through that. So this is a comparison with radio observations. Here's the radio image, here's the pulsar motion, and this is the final simulation stopped at 15,000 years. The density gradient is here. And so what I want to emphasize here, even though this isn't, we sort of tried different values for the ejected densities, values that approximately reproduce the morphology of the pulsar wind nebula, but I want to show here how that what is chosen for the ejecta mass, the morphology of the pulsar wind nebula is actually very sensitive to what is chosen for the ejecta mass. And there is actually, there are degeneracies. So for example, if the unless the supernova remnant is much younger and an ISM density lower, then we definitely favor this higher ejecta mass for this supernova remnant. But additional studies are needed to constrain some of these other parameters so that we can really put a constraint on the progenitor mass. Okay, so the final study that I would like to mention is a study of the Vela supernova remnant and its pulsar wind nebula Vela X. This is a large XMM study with additional Chandra data. What is shown here is the supernova remnant in X-rays, the outline, the radio contour of the pulsar wind nebula is shown in white, and these small circles here are all the different XMM pointings that were used in this study to analyze the non-thermal and thermal emission. So the results are that thermal emission for supernova ejecta is found in that innermost region, and the similar hydrodynamical simulations that I showed previously do show that, do confirm that thermal emission would be expected from the ejecta that is mixed in with the pulsar wind nebula material following the reverse shock interaction. There is this cocoon structure of thermal emission here that is, I don't know if you can see it well from the circles, but that is also reproduced by these simulations. So this suggests that this structure of thermal emission can be reproduced from a scenario in which the pulsar wind nebula is crushed by the reverse shock that results from a density gradient with a higher density in the northeast. So just to conclude, summary is basically that progenitor and explosion properties of composite supernova remnants can be constrained from observations and modeling of pulsar wind nebulae themselves, as well as the interaction of the pulsar wind nebulae with the host supernova remnant. So this is just, I don't know how I'm doing on time, but just a quick summary. So these young pulsar wind nebulae, I hope I convinced you that they are powerful probes of the innermost ejecta and dust, and that they can be used to probe the abundances of the innermost material, and that we can use that to say something about the progenitors of these systems. And then as we move on to systems in the later stages of evolution, we can use the observational constraints in combination with modeling of the interaction with the reverse shock to say something about the structure of the ambient medium, the pulsar's motion, as well as the supernova ejecta masses that produce these, that can reproduce these morphologies that we're observing. So I'll end there. Thank you. And hopefully I didn't miss anything.
No, Taya, that was remarkable. You've gone through a lot of hurdles, and power outage was one of them.
Thank you.
To do this today. That was very good. Okay, we're ready for questions. Bill's got his hand way up.
Taya, that was spectacular. I'm trying to take advantage of the cross-fertilization we get at a meeting like this. We heard that most massive stars are in binary or triple systems and so forth. So when you talk about a progenitor mass, based on your analysis, is that assuming a single star evolution? Is it just giving you a number for whatever it was that blew up that could have been a binary system that had mass transferred on it, so its mass is higher than its zero-age main sequence mass? So what exactly does your progenitor mass mean?
Exactly. So what we are assuming here, at least for those, for example, for Cas75, for those nucleosynthesis models, those are single stars models. So the ejecta mass is still, I believe it's pretty robust in that case, but we don't necessarily know whether that was a binary where a lot of the mass has been lost, or whether it's a single massive star. So that could go either way. We're not constraining that, but here for the abundances, we are assuming single star evolution.
Yeah, and I'm just going to pick up on that. So you showed these animations of the pulsar wind nebula evolution in an environment and such, and I know already that's challenging enough, but if I heard correctly, you assumed either a constant wind density or maybe a gradient, right? But you know, from Nathan's review talk, we know that, that these stars are sculpting their environments potentially very significantly, which would alter the environment and change the evolution. And I know I'm highlighting a spotlight, but this is where progress can be made, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
Yeah, maybe to follow up a bit on that. So about the reverse shock interaction, it seems that in order to reproduce the asymmetry, you need to assume a relatively large density contrast and over large sizes. Is there a way to observationally confirm that you indeed have these high density regions?
Yes. So for example, one remnant that I didn't show because that was an older study, G327, for example, it's a similar reverse shock interaction where we assume the density gradient that we actually measure from X-ray observations, from thermal X-rays. The uncertainties are too large to really say like what the magnitude of the gradient is, but we can just tell that the density is higher in one part of the remnant. And the one that I showed, MSH 1556, we also have XMM observations that I should have already analyzed, but getting to that, where the purpose of those observations were to actually constrain the density in the surrounding ambient medium so that we can put additional constraints on these models.
See a hand in the back there. Yes.
My question is about Cas75. It's very interesting, and I like your method. So you constrain a relatively low progenitor mass. So we use the wind-blown bubble and constrain a mass very similar to yours. So I really like that result. But my question is about accuracy of the C to the carbon to oxygen ratio. So you use the carbon plus to derive the a ratio, but in such a low density region, the carbon might in the phase of ionized carbon or in the neutron phase or even in molecular phase. So how accurate is your abundance ratio measurement?
So let me now think. So for the carbon to the oxygen one ratio, there are certain assumptions that we made based on that are assumed in the shock models. We assume that both carbon 2 and oxygen 1 come from the extended ionization region. So for example, and if that's not the case, that might not necessarily hold. So I think like an observation at additional wavelengths for additional species would help us constrain that. And hopefully I'm explaining that Bonchul Ku, who helped do most of these shock models is here. Maybe he can comment a little bit more on that, or John Raymond as well. Maybe not.
I did see a hand up in the back there. Yes?
Thank you. So my question is more or less a curiosity. In your maps, I suppose that the black circle that we see in the center, let's say, is the region in which you are injecting the wind, right?
Sorry, say that again.
The black circle that you have in the middle of your maps is the region in which you are injecting the wind, I suppose, right? Or not?
Yes, in the simulation or the...
Yes, in the simulations, of course. So my question is, are you sure that that black circle is smaller at every time than the termination shock? Because in some cases it seems not. So it is one of the most difficult things in these kind of simulations, I know.
Yes, so... No, we are not certain of that, I believe. So we are sort of, in these simulations, I think we are confident of sort of the global large scale morphology that's produced, but the innermost regions, that I wouldn't necessarily trust that. I don't know if Pat, can you weigh in on the innermost region? I think Pat can say something more about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that still the large scale morphology would not necessarily.
Yes,
change.
That's correct. I think that the point is that after the reverse shock crosses the pulsar, there can be points where it pushes the plasma back far enough that the termination shock is close to our simulation boundary. So there may be some details. In that innermost region after that late phase, but the overall global morphology, I think, will be unaffected by that.
Question in the back there.
Excuse me. Just a comment on Cas75. Here you use the latest distance of about 5.8 kpc. And previously there are two works on the molecular line observation that revealed that supernova remnant Cas75 is interacting with molecular clouds. Separate with CL120 and CL2.1 transition. So given the interaction with molecular clouds, then another way of determination for the distance were given. So the the distance given in that way is 10, is about 10 kbc. So if using the different distance as 10 kbc, then the real age of the pulsar perhaps is very similar to the previously determined by Gotthelf, that is about 700 years.
Okay.
So
the
distances, you know, they are always challenging. As to respond to that, maybe you can discuss why it was updated. I don't know if you went into detail about that, the new estimate that changed from previously, and then maybe comment on the question.
So if I remember correctly, that the, and maybe I don't, because my brain is only half working, but the large distance estimate was based on the absorption along the line of sight, where the latest distance estimate was based on the H1 morphology around the and the correlation with H1,
okay.
And the correlation with the remnant,
okay.
And so that's where the revision came from. But
and the question now is, you're citing evidence where interaction with a molecular cloud, and there's a different distance for that. Were you aware of this?
I know that there are several studies with distance estimates within the entire range between
yes.
6 and 19 kiloparsecs. This is the 5.8 is the latest one that I think there was a discussion of that, but it seemed pretty convincing with the H1 observations. But yes, if the distance is revised, I'm pretty sure we can make the models work, but the interpretation may be different, because the models that we showed, especially the hydro models, are not necessarily unique. We can tweak the parameters to reproduce the morphology even for a larger distance, but of course that's going to change our estimates of the explosion energy and the ejecta mass and such. So so yes, the interpretation would change.
Yeah, but at the very least it seems to be coming towards us.
Yes.
As it were.
KESS 75 is moving towards us, yes.
Very good. Okay, on that note, another round of applause for Tejas.
Thank you.
Excellent review talk. And a thanks to everyone for an excellent session. We're going to, are there any announcements quickly? I think we're getting sandwiches as we go out, and have some fun today.